You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Alex toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ratu Tuesday. I'm your host Alex and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producer Liam. E whai ake nei coming up on the show. For Dear Science this week, our expert Dr. Kushla McGovern speaks with us about tardigrades, nanofiber drug delivery and Lingui the one-handed gorilla. For our weekly catch-up with the National Party, I spoke with MP Ryan Hamilton about the government's budget and what it means for health, students, and other parts of government spending. Liam, what do you have for us today?
Hi, Alex. For Greenwill this week, I spoke to Richard Cappy from Forest and Bird about the effects that the government's latest budget will have on the environment, which includes a $38 million cut to conservation. I also spoke to Andrew Deutschler from Watercare about Auckland's wastewater treatment system and the phasing out of Puketutu Island to dispose of our biosolids.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rāne, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware e ahei ana koutou, te whakarongo ke ēne kōrero āno, hei pakehere roki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi poho, me hairaki 95BFM i rakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Kia timata te whakatūranga, let's get into the show.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
And for Dear Science today, we are joined by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern.
Kia ora.
What does science have for us today?
Tardigrades, drugs and nanofibers, and a cool story about a gorilla. So, yeah, tardigrades, otherwise known as water bears or moss piglets. So if anyone's, I think it was one of the Star Treks, the more recent ones, Discovery or something, they had a huge tardigrade in it. But tardigrades are actually really tiny eight-legged animals. Like, they range from about 0.05 to about 0.5 millimetres in length, the longest being about 1.3. So they're tiny. But what's really cool about them is that they can survive some really extreme environments. Like, there's been reports of them surviving intense heat, really low or high temperatures, so like down to like minus 272 and up to 149 degrees for a short period of time, but they survive. They can survive in vacuum, the low oxygen environments, under a lot of ionizing radiation, and under high pressure. So the fact that these things can survive these really extreme environments has obviously made them very interesting to scientists. And so the study we're going to talk about today is one of these studies that's kind of looked into how do they survive extreme temperatures. So what we already know about tardigrades is that they undergo this reversible biological process called anhydrobiosis. So hydro in there, so you're probably already thinking water is in that somehow, right? So what they do is actually they lose most of their body water. And so basically their metabolism temporarily stops. And they go into the state that basically allows them to survive these extreme conditions. And they call it the tun state. So in the tardigrade, they kind of curl up on themselves. And so what these scientists did was they took some active tardigrades and they took some that were in this tun state. And they basically put them in a range of in tubes and they heated them for a range of temperatures from 45 to 85 degrees Celsius for an hour and to see how many survived or didn't survive. But what was also really interesting about the study is they actually measured the flow of heat through the tardigrade. So how thermally conductive was it? So if you think of polystyrene versus metal, you know, metals are very thermally conductive. They heat up very quick. Polystyrene, not so much. And if you're not careful, you'll melt it. And so what they did was, with looking at these different environments, what they found is if the tardigrades were active, they didn't even survive 45 degrees for 1 hour. I was kind of thinking about that. You know, there are humans that now live in some of those temperatures, and that would be seriously uncomfortable. But of the tun state, so these tardigrades that have undergone that process of anhydrobiosis, about 90% of them survived at 45 degrees for an hour, and some even survived at 85 degrees at 1 hour for
That's
1 hour.
That's a big difference.
It is, right? Like, it's kind of incredible. And one thing, because they measured this thermal conductivity, what they found was when they were in the tun state, they're actually more thermally resistant. So they reduced the flow of heat going through them. So if you've not got the heat flowing through you, you're not damaging your internal cellular processes, and so you're preventing that heat damage. So what they're saying here is, like, so we already know with tardigrades that there's a lot of biochemical processes. They have unique proteins and levels of sugars and stuff that are protecting them against things like cold shock and heat shock and stuff. But they're also saying, okay, well, here's this kind of more of a physical process where they're basically rejecting heat in a way. They're not letting it flow through their bodies. So now they need to study what that molecular mechanism, so what are the molecules behind that that lead that to happen. But so could be, you know, used in the future in materials and stuff like that. But it's just really cool.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, I say this a lot, but it is one of those things that you kind of just look at and you go, it's amazing that they got there. Like, we got here.
Yeah.
Right, that's a thing that something can just do.
Yeah, and then I didn't realize this, but I never did this in school, but obviously some people do this in primary school and high school and stuff. So you can actually take moss from certain places in there, and you put a little bit of water in it, and then you kind of squeeze the water out and you collect the water and put it under a microscope, and you can actually find them and just see them like moving around, because they're bigger than the bacteria kind of thing. And
they are funny looking things. I do understand how they got all of their nicknames.
Exactly right. they really are moss piglets and water bears. And
anyway, that's great. Yeah. What is next on science?
So next is talking about treating brain cancers. So glioblastoma. So this is the most common and aggressive form of brain cancer in adults, and it's extremely difficult to treat, and it has a high rate of reoccurrence. And why it's kind of difficult to treat is because these tumours tend to be made up, they refer to it as heterogeneous cells. So there's lots of different types of cells. So they can kind of evade the treatment. So they adapt, basically. But we have something called the blood-brain barrier. And so this is a barrier to prevent stuff just getting up and around our brain. But it does mean if you're getting chemical therapies, it's preventing those getting to your brain as well. Like, there's a lot of work that's done about drug delivery through the blood-brain barrier.
And I never thought about that.
No, it's kind of interesting. There's a few different barriers within your body that it kind of protects certain regions of your body from, like, chemical intrusion and, like, infection and stuff. But then it can also, if you're trying to treat with drugs, it's a problem. And so you have to work out ways that you can get around this, but not to your detriment, right? And so this is what they've done in the study here, where they've wanted to basically work out a way that you could have localized long-term delivery. So localized, you're treating the tumor and you're treating it over a period of time, because of course it's in the brain, you don't want to keep going in there. And so that's what they've done here. What's also really cool is that because of that heterogeneous cell concept, they've looked at using multiple drugs. So they've basically made a bit of a cocktail of three FDA approved drugs. Now, whenever you mix drugs, you can basically get three effects. It can be negative, so two of your drugs or multiple of your drugs interact and they make something bad, and so it's bad for you. So you don't want that. That's not what you're aiming for. You can have additive, where this is like, they just do their job, but they don't really interact with each other. So 1 + 1 = 2. Or you can get synergistic effects, which is really you're kind of aiming, where you get more bang for your buck, right? So 1 + 1 = 3 now. The drugs interact with each other to improve their effect. And so they were able to identify these three drugs that could do this. But they still have this problem with the blood-brain barrier and how are we going to get it in there? So what they did was they've actually made a mesh from these fibers that are formed under a process called electrospinning. And so what that means is you basically have a polymer solution that you put your drug into, and your solution has some charge to it. And so then you put it in an electric field, and this electric field basically just draws out these really thin fibers, like nanometer to micrometer diameter. So there's actually a group in the chemistry department here that does some of this sort of stuff. And by doing this, they were able to make this mesh that had these three drugs in it, and it's so mesh that you can form and put into a certain region. So around the tumor area, that was probably, you know, and then it can localize long-term drug delivery because, of course, these drugs leach out over time. And so then they tested it in animals, mice. And so they basically put a mesh that had no drug in some mice, those are the controls, and then a mesh in the other mice that had the drug. And what they found, if they had no drug in their mesh, the mice died within 19 days. But of the ones that did get the drug-filled mesh, at 60 days, 60% of them survived. At 120 days, 40% had survived. And at 120 days, they actually cut the experiment. So they actually did see some significant increase in lifetime.
There's a lot more than
19. Yeah, right. So now they've proved the concept, right? So now you can start to do stuff about controlling drug dosage and release more, and playing with the implant geometry so that it can be more effective. And obviously there's a lot of work going through clinical trials and stuff before we'll see it in people, but it's quite exciting.
Medical marvels, really. It's always fun to learn about.
Yeah, no, and it's quite cool if you see the picture of the mesh where someone's just got their gloved hand and holding it up, and you're like, it doesn't look like, it looks like a spider web, like a really thick spider web, basically. Yeah.
But hey, a thick spider web that could do good things.
Yeah.
What's up last? So I'm quite excited for this one.
Yeah, this is the story of Lengui. It's kind of more, it's not really a scientific study, it's more of a bit of a story that I found quite interesting, and it's natural history observation. And I think it kind of points out some sad stuff and some kind of nice stuff as well. So gorillas, we as humans share 98.3% of our genetic code with them. So our closest, they're basically our third closest cousins after chimpanzees, bonobos. So we probably should treat them a little bit better than we have. Mind you, that goes for all animals. So we know, most people will know, hunting, trade, habitat loss, disease have actually resulted in gorillas becoming critically endangered. And they've been this way for a long time, and they're probably going to be like this way for a long time because they have a low birth rate. They give birth about every 4 to 6 years. So they're not replenishing their population fast. There's two species of gorilla, the eastern and the western, and each of those have two subspecies. But we're going to talk about a western lowland gorilla called Lengui. And why this she's kind of exciting at the moment is because, despite the odds, she's become a mum for the second time. And I say despite the odds because she's had a hard life. So go back to 1994, and Lengui was discovered as an 18-month-year-old in a maize field, so a cornfield. And the only remains of her family about her was the severed hand of her mother that had been caught in a snare. So, yeah, this is something that poachers do, or still do, and did a lot in the past, whereas they'd snare their gorillas and get them. So Lengui got discovered. However, the villagers that discovered her, who tended this field, tied her to a stake, fed her a little bit, with the idea that they could sell her in the near future. Some people at a nearby park called Odzala National Park caught wind of this, and so they sent out a scout, basically, to see if this was true. They found out it was, so then they went in and rescued her, and she ended up in the Espinels Foundation Brazzaville Gorilla Orphanage in April 1994. So she's in somewhere that's going to look after her now. However, things weren't looking great because she was about half the weight she should have been, and she was infected with intestinal worms. Her wounds from the rope were infected, so they didn't have high hopes, but she managed to survive. And so she was released into the wild in 1998 because where she was living, they had to have a temporary evacuation because there was the Second Republic of Congo Civil War. But she was released into her current home, which is this wildlife national park that still exists and where she is now, Lesoa Luna. And so she roamed around for a while, and they use camera traps to kind of monitor and see where there is. However, in 2002, her group roamed into an area of the national parks that wasn't actually being managed as heavily as some of the other parts, and so some hunters had managed to go undetected, and she got caught in a snare. And so she managed to get herself out, But in getting herself out, the snare tightened around her arm and it did so much damage that it was beyond repair. And she got an infection and it was going up her arm. So they decided to amputate her hand. She managed to survive that. She got re-released into the wild and went off and did her thing. And then for about 4 years, they didn't see her. So they didn't catch her on any of the camera traps. And so they were quite worried that she'd, the hunters had got her again, basically. But then they did spot her in 2018. And she'd been either in that time or just after she was pregnant and had a baby in that. And then just last year, they started seeing her footage of her in camera trap again, going, oh, she looks pregnant again. And in February this year, she actually gave birth and they confirmed on a camera trap, but they only kind of really said anything in last month or around April sort of thing that she had confirmed. And so you can go onto the website that's linked to and see a picture of her carrying her little baby and using her her arm with no hand and that. So life will still be pretty tough, but she's surviving.
A life of turmoil for sure, right?
Yeah, you know, like the gorillas have had it pretty rough. Like, yeah. But she's
poaching is bad.
Yeah, no, it is. And then when you're in an area that's also got a lot of turmoil politically, and then turns out, I don't know about the recent Ebola crisis, but definitely in the 90s and stuff, Ebola also affects them. Mm. And yeah, so they face a hard road.
Yeah, it's a big thing that I've learned about recently is that, like, human diseases are a problem for primate populations, yeah. Right? Because we're close enough that it's like, hey, that monkey will get sick if you're near him.
And then vice versa, right? Yeah. So there is that jumping of species.
It's not really a feel good story, but it's like a little bit.
It is a little bit. You get like, you know, like you, yeah, seriously, watch the video because you see the little baby gorilla and it's really cute. But it is nice to see that she survived. And there are these amazing organizations that are like looking out for these things. Yeah. And also, in a lot of these spaces as well, where there was a lot of the poaching, there's been a lot of effort around tourism and stuff, so you make your money from people seeing the animals rather than you make your money from the animal part sort of thing, so it's kind of encouraging.
Wow, thank you very much. Thanks Kushla for joining us. Thanks Motet, and thank you Science. Motet After Dark, enjoy beats, eats and collection treats after hours this weekend. Book now at motet.nz.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We'll be right back.
I can see you.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
Last week, the government announced the 2026 budget. Predictably focused on saving money and reducing the government deficit, the budget does see some key areas for funding. Health, while receiving a large chunk of funding, still has looming concerns around staffing, operating costs, and whether this increasing funding will make a difference for the struggling sector. The military and tertiary education have also seen critical allocation choices that have caused discussion in the days since, with defence spending being a big winner, and uproar from students following the removal of fees-free and raised fees despite an increase in funding. The budget also saw comments made by Finance Minister Nicola Willis about superannuation, saying that it was time for political parties and the government to consider superannuation's cost on the New Zealand taxpayer, which has signalled some disagreement with NZ First and Labour. Last week's budget has seen an allocation of funding to health, but what does the National Party say to concerns that, while matching inflation, the increase in funding might not make up for the currently underfunded state of the sector?
Gosh, I mean, we've committed to increases in health in the last few budgets. I think certainly when you look at the budget, health was again the winner on the day with, you know, over $1 billion of new money. But I guess the thing to realise too is that throughout that whole process, we're also trying to find efficiencies within the health system. And of course, we've brought back our targets. So not only have we increased funding, but we are also finding efficiencies within the health sector and trying to make transparent the targets and publishing those targets they were aiming for.
And when specifically looking at the issue of understaffing, which has been a heavily emphasised issue in the health sector, how does the National Party expect this budget to help with understaffing?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, like, it's not even just related to this budget. I mean, if you look at what we've done across the health sector over the last few years, you know, we've obviously tried to make... We've had a lot of overseas registered doctors in New Zealand that had, you know, had challenges getting their licences, so we tried to streamline that. We've allowed another 100 overseas doctors to come in. We're trying to make it easier for nurses to integrate into the system, and we've also got high levels of nursing and doctor graduates. You know, obviously, we've just announced the new medical school, which will create more GPs. New Zealand, you know, trained GPs at a grassroots level with a target for the rural areas where they do struggle to hold GPs. So it's a completely different format, and that's a graduate degree. So we're also going to, so essentially what that means is anyone with any degree can now apply to be a doctor, which means you're not just going to get, you know, your usual sort of 18, 19-year-old, you know, top 1% students coming through the system. You're going to have 25-year-old, 30, 35-year-old, 40-year-olds that want to retrain, do something different, so you're going to get a much more diverse workforce entering as GPs as well. So we've tried to take quite a holistic you know, approach to health services. In fact, hired more nurses than I think we've done previously. So there's a lot going on in that space, and it's going to take some time to optimise, but certainly I think you know, some really good things happening there. And then obviously the 10-year digital infrastructure strategy, which Minister of Health introduced last year, you know, a long-term program which will optimise some of the efficiencies with software and data, also cyber protection. But yeah, a 10-year strategy, which was, you know, pretty coherent, and will take a while to implement. But as that journey continues, I'm sure we'll find some more of these efficiencies and gap identifiers as well.
Another point of interest in the budget is the seeming lack of attention to the environment, particularly in terms of responding to climate concerns. Is this an intentional gap, or is this an area that the government will look to with changes that aren't in this budget?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're doing some, you know, huge RMA reform, and that's got massive environment implications in it. And we've transferred what was the Ministry of the Environment into MCIRT, or the Ministry of Cities, Environment, Regions and Transport. And So what we're trying to do there is actually make, rather than have the Environment Ministry sit out as a siloed entity that kind of, you know, sits on the side, we're actually trying to integrate it into all our planning programs, because, you know, you can't have new roads without obviously having an impact on the environment and all city growth and, you know, regional infrastructure, because it's all interrelated. And so we're actually trying to, despite, you know, what the opposition might say, we're actually trying to incorporate good environmental management into that economic conversation, because they are so integrated.
And looking elsewhere, what does the National Party say to concerns over the fact that despite, you know, these cost-cutting measures across the board, including further cuts to the public sector, the government has seen fit to allocate $1.58 billion to defence spending? Why is this an area that the government see as important?
Well, I guess two reasons jump to mind for me. I mean, obviously, one, the first is that we've probably sweated the assets and neglected to really give defence, you know, spending and budgets the, you know, the integrity that they've needed, and, you know, across multiple governments over the last 10, 15 years, in terms of, you know, the accommodation where our defence personnel, you know, work and live and train, but also, you know, the technology, we've let go a lot. And, you know, when we look across the global volatility, if we're going to play a meaningful part, we need to show that, you know, we're investing in our defence force and capabilities as well. And as our Prime Minister articulated, you know, so well a few weeks ago, national security is economic security. And if we don't build not only in terms of our own infrastructure capability, but our integration with, you know, our Pacific neighbours as well, and all those alliances, if we're not co-investing and showing that we're aligned, then how can we, you know, effectively put our money where our mouth is? More than ever, we need to have, you know, strong trade relationships and partnerships, especially across the Asia-Pacific region. We've seen some stronger relationships with the Australian Defence Force, so we can sort of leverage off each other's strengths a lot more. There's some really good work done there. So, yeah, it's pretty comprehensive, and it is a big investment, but our economic security is, much like I said with the economic and environment, our economic security is also tied into our national security.
And this budget has caused uproar amongst students in particular, as leading up to the announcement of the budget that the government would be cutting fees free for tertiary students. The removal of fees free, combined with allowing universities to raise their fees yet again, have led to serious concern despite an increase in funding to universities from the government. Why has the National Party kind of seen this area of tertiary education as somewhere to maybe look to cut costs?
Well, essentially because it wasn't working. You know, we had concerns when Labor brought it in. You know, it was brought in without, you know, clear data or evidence that it would move the needle. And, you know, it's always noisy when someone's got an expectation of something and you take it away. So, you know, obviously, you know, some students would have had an expectation then that, you know, last year would be free, and so that creates a bit of noise. So obviously it was first year free. We saw in our first year of government that there was no change to moving the needle in terms of kids in education. We moved it to the last year as an incentive to try and help students complete their studies, but it didn't change the data in terms of those that were already on track to do it. And so I guess, you know, we've got to look at that the student loan schemes, or tertiary education, is about 80% already subsidised by the government. In fact, it's one of the most subsidised in the OECD. And then on top of that, the gap, if a student needs it, can have an interest-free student loan paid off over the next, you know, sort of 5 to 10 years, depending on the loan. So we didn't think it was really detrimental to doing that. And in fact, we said we're going to now reinvest some of that funds into trade. So we've doubled the ability for Trades Academy, which has been quite a success. And that's, you know, obviously going to be more plumbers, sparkies, you know, people, you know, building houses and getting those qualifications, because that's been a program that has worked reasonably well. So I think every government has to look at those, you know, those levers and see where they can shift the dial.
And finally, superannuation has made headlines following the release of the budget, as Finance Minister Nicola Willis mentioned that it is an area that maybe we should reconsider the sanctity of when looking at the country's financial spending. Importantly, this kind of sets itself into opposition with New Zealand First. Going into this next election with New Zealand First having sworn off working with the Labour government, is this something that we're likely to see come up in conversations between National and NZ First over a potential coalition?
I think we're definitely going to see something. I mean, we'll definitely bring something out to the campaign, you know, around super. I mean, it's the elephant in the room that, you know, we all have to mature and create a pathway out of, because it is unsustainable. You know, in my view, it has been unhelpful with some of that noise from New Zealand First, but we'll be campaigning on our own policy and strategy as we get closer to the election. And then obviously, following the election, we'll have to see where it lands, and hopefully that we can chart a path that New Zealanders are on board with, and that they can understand and appreciate that the status quo isn't going to work for our children and grandchildren's generation.
That was National MP Ryan Hamilton on the 2026 budget.
That was our weekly chat with National MP Ryan Hamilton.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
She has to discipline her body, 'cause she knows that it's demanding to defeat those evil machines. I know she can beat them. Oh, Yoshime, they don't believe me, but you. I know she can be.
Yoshime. They don't believe me, but you won't let those robots defeat me. Yoshime. They don't believe me, but you
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
What's this button do?
Whoa!
You are now entering the green world.
Last week, the government announced their budget, which included $38 million of cuts to conservation in New Zealand. This comes amid other moves by the government, including the disestablishment of the Ministry for Conservation, as well as the Conservation Amendment Bill, which could see protected conservation land sold off. For Greenworld this week, I spoke to Richard Cappy, Chief Advisor for Forest and Bird, about what the government's budget means for conservation, what impacts it will have on the environment, and how this fits into the government's approach to the environment. To what extent are environmental issues being addressed in this budget, and what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, it's not good news for nature. So if we look, say, at conservation, the main kind of headline is that over $38 million has been cut from conservation funding in the next 4 years. So that's the money that's used to look after, a third of New Zealand for all of us. You know, the amazing places that we love, places that people from all around the world come to see. And it's the money that's used to look after, like, all those incredible native species that we all care about. You know, our kiwi, our kakapo, tuatara, all sorts of things like that. You know, it's incredibly important that we are investing in and looking after that stuff. So a $38 million cut in that funding isn't good news, but actually that's only part of the story, because that $38 million cut is also on top of cuts from 2024 and 2025 budgets. So the real picture over the next 4 years is that DOC's budget is being cut by close to $200 million. Now, given that's a department that, you know, that's like a quarter of its budget. And, you know, that's terrifying in terms of what that will do to our ability to look after our environment, after, our conservation lands. I think, you know, New Zealanders will be really, really angry and upset about that.
Yeah. And what do you think it will do to our ability to look after the environment?
Something's got to give, right? So these are cuts to what's called, DOC's baseline, so the money it actually gets to do stuff. So this isn't kind of back office things or anything like that. This is the nature's equivalent of frontline services. And the other bit is that if you look at the numbers, which is, you know, most people don't dig into the detail, there's another figure in there, which is there's no money put aside to pick up for things like inflation or the fact that things are going to cost more in coming years. So the overall shortfall is closer to $400 million in the next 4 years. Yeah, so something has to give. You know, we have incredible species. I mean, we've got 4,000 species in New Zealand that are threatened or at risk, right? So the idea that our environment is in good shape isn't true. You know, things that we celebrate, that we care deeply about, are really at risk. And the thing that's kind of holding the line in keeping some of these things from, in effect going extinct, is the hard work that's been put in on the ground by a lot of people at DOC, but also a lot of volunteers who work incredibly closely with these people. You know, this stuff matters, because, you know, if we lose those species, they're gone forever.
Do you think our conservation efforts will be able to cope with these cuts?
I think they're a breaking point already. So, you know, something will have to give. You know, there's already a lot of work going on around how you can make choices, but, you know, the government's really stripping funding to levels that basically mean that, you know, we will no longer be able to do the conservation work that's needed. And the scary thing is actually what the government's answer to this seems to be, which is, you know, a couple of weeks ago there was something called the Conservation Amendment Bill put into Parliament, which basically allows the government to sell and commercialise conservation land. So it opens up 60% of the conservation estate. So that's millions and millions of hectares of land will be now eligible to be considered for sale. And 100% of conservation land, so including our national parks and things like that, will be opened up potentially for economic development. So the answer seems to be we will try and make money out of our conservation estate. So quarrying, mining, more and more tourism as a way to try and fill that gap. But the bit that's interesting is there's no guarantee that any of that money, even if we wanted to go down that route, which I think New Zealanders do not want to do, would even make it back into conservation. We're just seeing that something that is incredibly important to all of us just being massively underfunded. And I don't know about you, but, you know, I quite often say, you know, New Zealand makes $18 billion a year from tourism, right? The reason tourists come to New Zealand, they might come and have a look at the Sky Tower, they might go to Te Papa, but I guarantee most of them want to go and actually check out our amazing landscapes. They want to go and check out these incredible native creatures that you can only find here. And guess what? The reason that those landscapes are as pristine as they are, the reason we've still got those species is that we are looking after them with conservation funding. So we're cutting that right back and we're putting all that income from tourism, not to mention the money we get from our primary industries, which are underpinned by fresh water, arable soils, things like that, all at risk. It just doesn't make any sense.
You've stated that the latest budget was a missed opportunity. What did you expect to see, and what more would you have liked to see in this budget?
To be honest, I think you know everybody was, I think, going into this budget thinking we're not going to, you know, there is going to be no new investment. But I think, you know, there's a difference between no new investment and holding the line and making sure that we're at least funding an important part of our society and our country to actually be able to look after things that are precious for us. So, you know, the expectation would have been we should have at least been able to make sure that DOC had the funding it needed to hold the line, even if we weren't prepared to actually go further. And I think the bit that also strikes me is, you know, there is an opportunity here. Like, we collect something called the International Visitor Levy at the border, and that's basically $100 per person. And we tell people it's collected for tourism infrastructure and for conservation, right? So you land at Auckland Airport, you've paid your $100, and you think, you know, as a tourist, you think, okay, I'm doing my bit, you know, I'm going to go and get to see all these things. I'm going to be using, you know, the public loos at the national park, and I'm doing my bit to help look after the biodiversity. So last year we collected $190 million. So 50-50 split, $95 million for conservation, $95 million for tourism. Have a guess how much actually DOC got. It's $55 million.
Right.
Of which $33 million was actually for biodiversity. So what happened to the other $40 million? Well, actually, that's something that they call a baseline swap, right? That means it goes back to Treasury, which says, oh, hang on, we're already giving you some money, so we'll just count that instead.
Right, so it's not all being used for its initial purpose.
No, so there's a kind of magical money shuffle going on. And again, that's a missed opportunity. If we're collecting money for conservation at our borders and we're telling people it's being collected for conservation, we should be ring-fencing that and we should be making sure it's going on top of the money that we're already putting in. So, you know, when the government talks about, hey, we're going to generate money out of the conservation estate to be able to do more conservation, you'll have to excuse me if I'm not convinced that that's going to be the case.
Yeah. Are there particular areas of focus you'd like to see more investment in and more funding?
Yeah, I think, you know, looking after our incredible biodiversity is something which we know needs to happen. The good news is, you know, we have those 4,000 threatened species. Obviously, a huge amount of effort goes into that. I think one of the things that tends to be quite difficult is it tends to be easier to kind of attract funding and invest in things that can make us feel good. So, you know, if we want to put money into Kiwis, it tends to be a lot easier to get support for things like that, things that people have heard of. I think one of the things that's really cool is actually over the last couple of years, Doc have done some really good work to be able to kind of understand where they need to put their effort and where they need to prioritize things based on things like, you know, how at risk things are, you know, how much money it would take to have what kind of impact. And I think one of the things we've got to be very careful of is, you know, bright, shiny new initiatives that might make us feel good, but actually don't do the hard mahi. So, you know, I've always said, you know, when we've met with ministers, when we meet with people who are asking about, you know, what they could do around conservation, you know, our lens is pretty clear, which is, you know, let's not get carried away with the things that might make us feel good. Let's look at the things that are actually going to make the biggest difference. And that's actually some of the really cool work that Doc's done. The thing is, they still need funding. We've got to back them. You know, they've done some really good work to be able to say, look, this is where the effort's needed. This is how we can get the best bang for our buck. But if they haven't got any money, then that makes that exceedingly difficult.
Yeah. I mean, practically speaking, how is this money used on a day-to-day basis? And what do these cuts represent for frontline services? So,
well, you think of, you know, you've got the biodiversity side of things and then you've got the visitor side of things. So you've got a lot of the kind of DOC infrastructure, so like tracks, trails, bridges, all sorts of things like that scattered all over the place. But then it's that money which is spent for really looking after endangered species. So, you know, rangers on the ground working with local volunteers to make sure that we're trapping, that we've got breeding programs in place, that we're monitoring actually the biodiversity health of our nahere, our manu, our awa, so that, you know, we are actually putting the money into, for example, making sure that we've got kakapo chicks coming through, that we are looking after, you know, some of the southern dotterels that are out there, you know, doing massive pest control programs. You know, things that if we weren't doing, we would be watching our native species basically heading fast towards extinction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then that's what that work does. I think quite often we think of DOC as, you know, the men and women and their kind of, you know, green and kind of grey shirts, you know, being the rangers at the huts and things like that. But there's so much more work that they do. You know, science, research, but that hands-on protection, basically keeping these species, keeping them going so that, hey, we can enjoy them, we can feel pride in them. We're fulfilling our responsibility as a country to looking after, you know, DNA that only exists here.
Yeah.
Now, this is the only place in the world where these things live. So, you know, the responsibility isn't just to us as New Zealanders, it's actually, hey, it's us playing our part globally.
Well, what does this say about the government's commitment to environmental issues over the last 3 years? And what legacy do you think they will have with the environment?
Yeah, so I've talked a lot about conservation. You know, the environmental side of things is even bigger than that, right? So over the last 3 years, we've gone as far as saying, look, there's a bit of a war on nature that's been going on. So, you know, you've probably heard of something called Fast Track, which is opening up, you know, big parts of New Zealand to economic development, to mining, to quarrying, to housing development, to new roading and infrastructure, but without environmental checks in place. We've got resource management reforms, which frankly don't sound very sexy, don't sound very important, but actually are fundamental to all of us because they determine what gets built where. And the reforms that are going through just now, you know, there's an opportunity to really modernize the system, to do things better. But what we've got is this idea that actually we need to, the way the government intends to do that is to make things worse for the environment. So, you know, and the mahi that's been done around climate action is frankly, you know, just regressive. We've paired our action on climate change back to the bone. We've kicked agricultural emissions back into touch. We're exploring a new LNG terminal up in Taranaki. We're talking about coal mining. You know, it feels like we're running as fast as we can back to the 1980s. So, you know, in some ways, this budget is just, you know, I'd love to say it's a one-off. I'd love to say it's an aberration. But, you know, the last 3 years have been brutal for the environment. And this budget is just the icing on the cake.
Yeah, is there anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, probably the main thing is, you know, I think all your listeners have got an opportunity. It doesn't matter what political party, you know, they intend to vote for. I think there's a couple of things they can do. If they care about the environment, they should be talking to their candidates and MPs and saying, what are you going to do to protect these places that I care about? Because if our politicians aren't hearing from us that nature and the environment matters, then actually the kinds of things we've been seeing are just going to carry on. So, you know, Forest and Bird works across all the political parties. You know, we're not a political organisation, but we need all your listeners to be out there, you know, actually asking those questions, because nature can't vote, but we can.
That was Richard Cappie from Forest and Bird speaking about the government's latest budget and its impact on the environment.
That was The Green World.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
The Mangere Wastewater Treatment Plant is Auckland's largest, dealing with over 70% of Auckland's wastewater. Biosolids, the byproducts of this treatment process, are currently transported to the neighbouring Puketutu Island as part of a project to rehabilitate it. However, by 2035, the Puketutu Island Rehabilitation Project will be phased out, and a new strategy will be needed to deal with Auckland's biosolids. I spoke with Andrew Deutschler, Head of Wastewater Planning at Watercare, about what Auckland's wastewater system looks like, the challenge and potential solutions we are facing with our biosolids, and how Aucklanders can be involved and provide feedback in this process. So before we start, could you tell us a bit about the wastewater system in Auckland and the role that the Mangere Treatment Plant and Puketutu Island in particular play within it?
Sure. So Watercare runs a extensive wastewater system that provides wastewater servicing for roughly 1.7 million people around the city. The Mangere Wastewater Treatment Plant is our largest wastewater treatment plant, so that services about 1.2 million people all across the central and western isthmus, so out to Waitakere, and then down through sort of Hawick, Pakaranga, into South Auckland, down to Drury. So quite a big area, and that's all serviced by the Mangere Wastewater Treatment Plant. The relevance of Puketutu Island, so the biosolids that are produced at Mangere Wastewater Treatment Plant, which are a very wet soil-like material. That's a byproduct of the wastewater treatment process. We are currently using biosolids from Mangere to rehabilitate an old quarry on Puketutu Island. The intent of that is that we will use those biosolids to rehabilitate the quarry and eventually restore the contours on the island, similar to what we used to have there with the volcanic cones. It's roughly a 20-year project for us, and we're halfway through, which is why we're working towards a new biosolid solution for 2035.
Yeah, so what are the potential solutions to phasing out the Puketutu Island?
Yeah, so for the scale of solution we need, so for the volume of biosolids that are produced at Mangere, there's two solutions that can cater to that need for Aucklanders. One is another landfill, so similar to what we have at Puketutu at the moment. And the other is an incineration facility, which is not something that's done in New Zealand from a biosolids perspective to date, but is something that's very common technology overseas, particularly in Europe.
Yeah, could you tell us a bit more about the landfill option? Will there be another potential rehabilitation project like we saw on Puketutu Island?
Yeah, for both those technology types, landfill and incineration, we're going through a process at the moment, a very structured, rigorous and robust process to look at potential options for those technologies, so how they compare against one another and potential locations. So exactly, say for a landfill example, if that was the solution that was chosen, exactly where and what that would be used for, it's simply too early to say at this stage, but it is possible that they could be used for another rehabilitation project if that was the option that came out as preferable.
Are there any that are sort of preferable from an environmental perspective?
For both landfill and incineration, we're looking at qu- quite a few technical inputs as part of our assessment process, and a big part of that is the environmental impact of those solutions. So that's one factor that we're weighing up, and sort of a core objective for the project, along with servicing growth across the city and enabling Auckland to grow, is making sure that we're being environmentally responsible for future generations, whatever the solution may be.
Is there any solution that Watercare is in favour of at the moment, or is it still just under consideration?
Still under consideration, and too early to say. We're, like I said, we're working through a process at the moment, and that will sort of consider all the factors that we need to consider in determining what that solution is. So that will become apparent in time, but right now we're really just working through our assessments.
Yeah, and how can the public get involved in this decision-making process?
Yeah, we're very keen to have the public engaged in this, and we've put a lot of focus into that already. So in terms of what's available now and where the public could turn their attention, we have a page on our website dedicated to this work, and we're also active on social media platforms regarding this. The engagement to date has been focused on education. So what are biosolids, what are the potential solutions, and also hearing from Aucklanders regarding what's important to them, and we're really keen to continue that through the second half of the year and beyond, so that when we do have an idea of what the solution could be, Aucklanders are much more informed and can participate in the conversation more meaningfully.
Yeah, so can we expect more details on the potential option as it goes ahead?
Yep, absolutely. Once we've done the right level of work to be able to communicate that. But the focus for us right now is working through all the technical and cultural assessments. And once we've done that and we're in a better position to understand what the solution is, then we'll start to communicate that outwardly.
What is the plan for the use of Puketutu Island once it is rehabilitated?
Puketutu Island is looked after by the Te Motu Aotearoa Trust. So Watercare is just leasing the land at the moment that was the former quarry. So once we have completed the rehabilitation project, the plan is to return that land that we're currently leasing to the trust for long-term maintenance and use.
Auckland has a growing population. Is our current wastewater infrastructure adequate, and can we expect changes, especially like regarding the Mangere treatment facility?
Yeah, so from a biosolids perspective first, yes, it is adequate. We produce biosolids and we produce wastewater every day, and so we're currently utilising Puketutu Island for the biosolids 24/7, 365 days per week. And the Mangere Wastewater Treatment Plant is already providing a reliable service for large parts of Auckland, and we have future upgrades planned for that site as well to ensure that it continue to meet its consent conditions, that it can operate reliably, and that it can service its population.
Yeah, thanks for that. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, that this biosolids project is really exciting and important for Watercare, and we feel it should be for Aucklanders as well. It will provide a really valuable service, sort of enabling the region to grow and also to have a sustainable environment. So we're very keen for Aucklanders to be engaged in that. So we really encourage people to be curious, take a look at the material that we have available, and then sort of participate where there's opportunities to provide feedback on what we're doing as well.
That was Watercare's Andrew Deutschler speaking about potential solutions to Auckland's biosolids challenge.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a rātou I kōrero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Tuesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Dr. Kushla McGovern, National MP Ryan Hamilton, Richard Cappy from Forest and Bird, and Andrew Deutschel from Watercare. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM, next up we've got the 1 to 4 with Jin.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.